Welcome to this edition of ACFE Podcast. I'm John Gill, Vice President of Education, and I have a very special guest today. I have Don Rabin. Don is retired from the Department of Justice of North Carolina, and while he was in that position, he did a lot of training, and now that he's retired, he's still doing training. He has his own company, and he does a lot of speaking engagements for the ACFE. So I've asked him to talk to me today and discuss the five common mistakes that he sees interviewers making. So let me turn it over to Don and let's talk about your top five mistakes that most people make during interviews.
First of all, John, thank you for that kind introduction. I hope I can live up to that. And I've always been appreciative of my association with the ACFE and all that it has afforded to me. As we address these five mistakes, I don't have these in any order. And the reason is I think they're all priority number one, because an interviewer could satisfy four out of the five and still that interview goes south. So while there's no particular order, I think they're all of equal importance. And the first one I want to put out is the failure to plan. I want to break this down into two components. Obviously, we talk about planning for a specific interview, depending on how much evidence we have, how much information we may have, all of the environmental factors that may go into conducting that interview. But most assuredly, if we're going to be dealing with a person who either has guilty knowledge or is the guilty individual, that individual has made some preparation, mentally or otherwise, in order to prepare for that interview. Now, so if the interviewer themselves has not made any preparation, I'm just going to go in there and wing it when I get in there, then this is going to give that guilty knowledge individual a distinct advantage, because all this individual is going to have to do is to implement the plan, and the interviewer themselves are going to have to develop a plan and implement the plan at the same time. So we've already given ourselves a double task as it is, and as we often talk about in class, particularly with regard to fraudsters, although it's not limited to that by any case, but they're going to manipulate things and they're going to manipulate people. And the things can be anything from computer programs to work records. We're limited only by our imagination. But on the front end of fraud, that individual is going to be manipulating somebody or some bodies with regard to carrying forth with regard to that fraud. And then on the other end, what we're talking about here, that individual is going to try to manipulate the interviewer to either give up or to accept what that individual is saying. So one way that we can help to overcome that is by that adequate preparation for a given interview. And I'll be the first to understand that we're all busy and life is growing even more complex. But that's not going to diminish the need for that adequate preparation for a given interview. My theory is this, that in a good interview, the sharing of talk time is 20% of the interviewer and 80% of the interviewee. In an outstanding interview, it should be about 10% of the interviewer and 90% of the interviewee. But if that interviewer is talking more, then the flow of information is coming from the interviewer to the interviewee, and that may be the last thing that we want. But if that guilty or guilty knowledge fraudster, let's just go with that, sitting across from that interviewer, then if that interviewer is spewing facts and data, whether it is correct or incorrect, they may be inadvertently telling the interviewee everything they know, or they may be telling the interviewee that there are things about this process that they don't know correctly, and that may be what the interviewee is going to choose to hang their hat on. The other part of preparation that I'm talking about is this. That's that individual preparation. I mean, I'm always curious with regard to someone that is paid to conduct interviews, exactly how much effort are they putting forth in order to prepare themselves for that communication event that we call an interview. I see the failure to prepare as a dyad in that not preparing oneself to take the field in the interview. And the other thing is not preparing for a specific interview by knowing the facts of the circumstance, knowing as much as they can about the interviewee, and having a plan for conducting that interview and an alternate plan, and more ideally, even a plan C.
Well, good. So we've got failure to prepare. What's a second error that you see often?
Confirmation bias, in that the interviewer making up their mind prior to conducting that interview, that judgment prior to inquiry, in that for whatever reason, the person has made up their mind before they go in there. I've conducted no small number of interviews where the people that either retain me or during the time in my law enforcement career where people had made up their mind about this individual. During the conduct of the interview, I determined that that was not the case. And so with this confirmation bias, what happens is this. The individual goes into the interview, and because they've already got their mind made up, they only see and hear and perceive the things that are in line with the conception that they've already fallen in love with. If there are verbal, vocal, and nonverbal indicators that are contrary to that, there is a tendency for that individual to just filter that out. And so it's important that that interviewer have the ability to go into that interview with an open mind and have a portion of that interview set aside so that they can allow that individual to talk, so that they can compare what this individual is saying with regard to what they know going in, to have the opportunity to form a read on this individual, what's this individual like when they're telling me things that I know the truth, and then as they go forward with their questioning, be able to hold those two completely different thoughts in their head at the same time, that maybe this individual on one end has done absolutely nothing, maybe the individual on the other end is the target and the guilty knowledge individual, or it could be something along the lines in the middle, is that this individual may have information relative to this that they may not be so readily willing to be forthcoming with. But right up there at the top, making up your mind going into that is problematic on a whole lot of levels, because to express disbelief to a truth teller can result in some of the nonverbal behaviors that are consistent with that of a deceptive individual. So failure to plan and that confirmation bias, that judgment prior to inquiry, are two most critical mistakes. The third mistake that I see is the interviewer getting into a comfort zone as far as their knowledge, skill, and ability. And then because of that comfort, you know, what I'm doing, the skills I have, my level of ability is working well for me, so that just like they say, a body at rest tends to stay at rest. The failure or the reluctance to enhance their ability, and I've told people this, and I believe this, I've been at it a long time. I've interviewed and interrogated the best of them, but I'm not as good an interviewer as I can be. I continue to try to improve my skills and enhance my skills, push those borders, because I don't know it all. I mean, when it comes to the complexity of interaction, one person with another, there's not a week goes by that I don't learn something new. And I believe that the best interviews I'm ever going to conduct in my career are still ahead of me. So the third mistake that I see, and I think, as I said, the longer somebody's been in the saddle, the easier it is to succumb to this unless they put forth the effort, and that is becoming very comfortable with a level of knowledge, skill, and ability that may have worked up to this point but may not work from this point on each and every time.
Now, what's your fourth most common error?
Okay, and we've been moving toward this. What I think it is the diminishing capacity or willingness to pay attention for an extended period of time. If you were to say, what have I noticed more than anything else over the last 10 years? It's the diminution of people's ability to pay attention for an extended period of time. What I've read lately says that the average adult attention span here in the United States is about 12 minutes and falling. I think the 12 minutes is a optimistic number, and I'm not saying it to be critical, but when you look at all of the things that are competing for our attention, you know, an iPhone, an iPad, we surf the web, spending about 10 seconds on a page at the most, so that we begin to become acclimated to quick changes of scenes, if you will. And so the ability to stay in the moment for the conduct of that interview is one of the mistakes that I'm seeing. And the reason that I call it a mistake is this, that paying attention is a form of self-discipline. And paying attention also is a act of courtesy to that interviewee. Paying attention, going back to what we talked about as far as the sharing of time between the interviewer and the interviewee, a critical part of that is that interviewer's ability to pay attention and to be focused on that individual verbally, vocally, and non-verbally, and to think. And I think one of the reasons that we call it paying attention is because we only have so much attentive cash in our pocket, and we may think that we can multitask and that we can mentally, cognitively balance several balls at the same time, but studies prove that not to be the case. And so this is one of the critical areas that I see that I think is going to have a profound effect as time goes on.
So, Don, what's your final advice for interviewers?
The other thing that I see is the interviewer taking the case or the interview itself personally. That, and you alluded to, I mean, it's not that we don't care. You know, you can get involved in a case, and I mean, I've worked, you know, child death and you name it. It doesn't mean that I don't care. But what it does mean is this, that whatever this individual that I'm interviewing did, they didn't do it to me. And no one has hired me to go into that room and pass judgment on that individual. If I become emotionally involved in the process, then I am not the controlling factor of the interview. At the point where I become emotionally involved, then rather than focusing on the interviewee, that causes me to focus inwardly. And I believe this, the interview should never be an emotional experience except for the interviewee. That at the point where the interviewer becomes emotionally involved in the process, then in a very real sense, the interviewee has become the controlling dynamic, because I've turned control of my emotions over to the individual. That I have to maintain that level of objectivity, and this goes right back to that judgment prior to inquiry. That if I'm dealing with a fraudster, then if he stole something, it wasn't mine. And my job is to get to the truth and not to pass judgment on this individual. And as we say in riding a motorcycle, the bottom line is this, you go where you look. So if you look to the right, that motorcycle's going to the right. In the interview environment, you come across how you think. And at the point where I give vent to my emotions, then at that point, that's going to affect the stimulus, my verbal, vocal, and nonverbal behavior toward that individual. And as we line up the fraud triangle, and particularly with regard to the whole dynamic of pressure, motive, and rationalization, people respond much more readily to understanding than they do to condemnation. Not only do I think it is the right thing to remain objective during the conduct of the interview, but I think it is the smart thing. And it's kind of like Nietzsche said, you got to be careful if you're slaying dragons, because you could become a dragon. And I think what happens is that after a while, in dealing with fraudsters or criminals of whatever nature, then if we're not careful, then there's a certain cynicism that can creep in, and if that's the case, then it's going to manifest itself in our verbal, vocal, and nonverbal behavior with that individual, and that is anathema to what we want to have happen during the conduct of that interview. I want to come across as one person talking to another, not a parent to a child. I want to convey that I understand the pressure motive someone may be going through that initiated this. I want to be able to understand their rationalization so that I can use that dynamic in order to gain compliance from that individual. And that's not going to happen if I become emotionally involved in the process. All of these things that we've talked about as far as failure to plan, making up our mind before we go into the door, getting comfortable with our abilities, losing the ability to pay attention for extended periods of time, and becoming emotionally involved, all of those play readily into the hands of the fraudster within the interview process. I think you're exactly right.
First of all, I'm just going to sum up, and you can, if I've missed anything, but you've got to know what you're doing. You've got to be prepared. And I think that is always crucially important. I was always afraid that I just wouldn't be able to understand what they were saying, and the interview would go nowhere. If I didn't understand the processes or procedures and the names, I'm not going to understand what I'm getting from the individual, and this was all going to be a waste of time. And confirmation bias, and that is something I think we all have to work on, to stop and think before that interview. Let me just go in with an open slate. Let me ask the questions and evaluate each response right then and there in real time. And maybe, you know, I have misjudged some of these areas. And then you're right, you do this enough, you kind of get into a habit of doing the same things every time and you know, be thinking about that when you're planning and when you're conducting the interview. Try and move things around, switch things up so you don't do the same thing every time. And pay attention. Do whatever you can. Practice on listening and talking to people and really evaluating what they have to say, and not be thinking about your messages or what you need to pick up at the store that night. And then just stay professional and calm, and don't allow them to upset you, or don't, whatever they did to your client or to your employer. Don't let that upset you. It's like I said, you're a fact finder, not the judge. Your job there is to collect all the information that you can in the best way that you can.
You're exactly right. You nailed it.
Well, Don, I really do appreciate your time today, and I hope that the listeners out there have gotten some good things to think about and that will help them improve their interview skills.
Well, John, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope that our conversation has given them something to think about, and I do appreciate the time spent with you.
Okay. Once again, my guest has been Don Rabin. Don is retired from the North Carolina Department of Justice and now does training on interview and investigation techniques. And on behalf of the ACFE, this is John Gill. Thank you for listening.